From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Corlott, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Iranian women played an important role in the Iran-Iraq War, but their contributions largely have been overlooked.
They want to be identified not as a superior being to their male counterparts, but as equals.
We'll talk with Matteo Farzani about his forthcoming book about Iranian women and the conflict. But first, Rebecca Cruz and I will discuss violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo and President Trump's policy change regarding Cuba.
One of the biggest concerns of the Trump administration's is that this new money that is being funneled into Cuba, and there is a significant amount of it, is that much of that is going to the government, particularly the military.
That's all coming up after news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Corlott. Rebecca Cruz, let's start with Cuba. This week, it looks like President Trump has rolled back some of the Obama administration's changes that were made in the U.S. policy toward Cuba. If we recall, there had been some lightening up of travel and commercial restrictions and other things that had happened, trying to normalize Cuban-U.S. relations. And President Trump suggests that those were too one-sided and that it didn't do enough or require enough change in Cuba, which he calls an oppressive communist regime. So tell us what you think about what might be happening here and maybe even what might not be happening, what might not be changing.
Well, this seems to be President Trump coming to terms or fulfilling some of his campaign promises. Some of the Cuban Americans in this country, he promised them that he would go back on this Obama pronouncement. He's not going entirely back. We're going to keep diplomatic relations. The diplomats are obviously going to go back and forth. There will still be educational groups that can go, but they're going to have new rules that they have to follow. Really what they're limiting is business as well as travel to Cuba on one's own. Now, one of the issues that seems to have come up is that of remittances. One of the biggest concerns of the Trump administration's is that this new money that is being funneled into Cuba, and there is a significant amount of it since the end of 2015 when these restrictions were initially lifted, is that much of that is going to the government, particularly the military. So one of the big issues of this proposed plan is that it expands the definition of who in Cuba is part of the government or the military. And that, of course, was one of Trump's big issues, was that we are funneling money in to support a corrupt government. And in fact, we are talking about remittances. And there are remittances from the United States to Cuba of about $3 billion annually. So that's quite a bit of money. But there are some officials that were not allowed to get that. That has, well, will potentially be expanded to include as much as a third of the population, as much as a million people will not be able to get that money in. And the additional issue there is that there is a mandatory conscription in Cuba. So at some point in their lifetime, if this goes forward, everyone will be affected by this limitation on remittances.
Of course, the critics of the administration, Trump administration's move is that this is Cold War rhetoric, Cold War policy that has failed in the past.
Absolutely.
So I guess we'll continue to see what happens and what developments emerge there. Well, let's move to Africa now, Rebecca, and talk about the DRC, Congo, about an event this week. Gunmen stormed a prison, releasing more than 900 inmates, most of which had been involved in mass killings in the northern part of the country. Now, this is the fourth prison break in just the last few weeks, with more than 6,000 inmates altogether being released. So this demonstrates a lot of things, the weakness of the Congolese state, the lack of potential peace in the country. I mean, are we just going to continue to see this sort of thing happening there?
Well, unfortunately, we have to remember that the Democratic Republic of the Congo has had years and years, decades of instability, and this is just one more example of that instability. I mean, we're talking about people right now in their economy that are making the same that they would have been making in 1970. So it's a struggling economy. There's a corrupt government. They lived through two civil wars that were really kind of Africa-wide wars. And there are these forces that have been involved. The Allied Democratic Forces are the ones that you're referring to here that are going in to these prisons, multiple prisons in the last month, as you mentioned, and trying to get their people out. And there's simply no infrastructure to stop them. And this obviously raises a lot of questions about this country trying to stabilize, trying to become perhaps more democratic. And if they can't keep their prisons stable and their prisoners in prison, then that raises a lot of questions for how they can move forward in the stability of the country.
Certainly not good news there. All right. Thank you so much, Rebecca, as always, for being here.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org or like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter. We're at WorldviewsKGOU and I'm at Suzette Gorlot. Next, I'll talk with Matteo Farzani about the role of Iranian women in the Iran-Iraq War. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Matteo Farzani is an expert on Iranian studies who teaches at Northeastern Illinois University in Chicago. His forthcoming book, Iranian Women and Gender in the Iran-Iraq War, explores the crucial role that women played during that conflict. Matteo Farzani, welcome to Worldviews.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to Worldviews, actually. You've been here before, so
That's
thank
right,
you for coming
year.
Back. So, of course, we talk about Iran a lot on this program. It's one of our favorite subjects, and you were here last year talking about some of the things going on in Iran. But I want to talk about your current project, because you're focusing on women in Iran for this current book you're working on, and in particular, you're focusing on the role of women in the Iran-Iraq War of the 80s. So tell us a little bit about what drew you to that subject. Why are you focusing on women in the war? And then what is it about women in the war that we should know?
So I am actually from the south of Iran, the southwestern region of Iran, where the war affected the lives of millions of people, including mine and my family. So what happened was I had done some research, some papers that I had published about the Iran-Iraq War and usage of Shiite ideology by the state to entice men to go to war and volunteer for martyrdom, so on and so forth. So in my research, I came across names of women here and there, but nothing substantial. And a few years ago, I visited the border town of Khorramshahr, which was captured by the Iraqis after 34 days of putting up a battle against the Iraqi army in 1980. And in the mosque, which is legendary for resistance to the occupation, I walked in and I saw a ton of portraits of men as being the martyrs and people that sacrificed everything. But there was not a single photograph of women. And that was my aha moment. I said, well, nobody's trying to even let the public know that there were women involved. So I started to work on the project casually, not for a book size project, but maybe an article or two. And then I came across all these memoirs that are coming out now by women that were actually participants in the war. There are literally hundreds of thousands of women that participated in the war. Some involuntarily were brought in by default to participate. Some actually volunteered. And they served in almost 17 different roles, 16, 17 different roles. It included women that actually volunteered for combat, women that actually were intelligence officers or operatives of the state, women who were nurses and doctors and surgeons in the battlefield, women that did transportation. They drove ambulances, they drove buses and trucks to the war zone. And we had thousands upon thousands of women that actually organized soup kitchens throughout the country that provided pretty much most of the meals that were provided to the war participants that were predominantly men. And one thing that I noticed in this work, and I like to kind of emphasize that in my work and here in this interview, is that all of these women that have written about the war, they want to be identified not as a superior being to their male counterparts, but as actually as equals. People that did the same amount of work, suffered the same way, if not worse, but did not get recognized for it. And I thought that would be a great message that pretty much all women are trying to have the same message globally. It's not just particular to Iran, but especially for an audience in the United States. I think it's very, very important to know that Muslim women, Iranian Muslim women, and non-Muslim women of Iran, because we had Armenian women, Jewish women, and Zoroastrian women, the minority religious groups of Iran, that actually contributed in more than one way to the war efforts.
So it's interesting to hear about all of the roles in which that these women played. I mean, some of them are fairly traditional. We expect women to be nurses, for example, medics, cooks. That seems to be pretty common. But there were women in combat, women on the front lines and during this war. And yet this is something that was not well known. And we often ask the question, you know, about how women's liberation or the role of women in Iran today, and yet they have been engaged in these kinds of activities for some time.
Absolutely. And even the Iranians that actually live inside Iran, if they were not involved in the war in some ways, I can't imagine how they couldn't be, because the war raged for 8 years. But suppose the ones that didn't care enough, either for the state or for the war itself, because it was so dramatic, even the people inside Iran don't know about this. So when I travel to Iran and I tell people I'm here to research about this, they're kind of like, oh, we didn't know that, you know, women actually participated. And then I point to many, many memoirs that have recently been coming out by women that actually have participated, the most famous being the story of a 17-year-old girl, Zahra Hosseini, who was involved from minute one when the Iraqis actually came to occupy the city of Khorramshahr. As a native, she stood against them, and she did everything from washing dead bodies to burying people to shooting dogs that were after, you know, the bodies that were left around the cemetery because there was just so many people and nobody was there to bury them, to transferring patients, to actually picking up a gun and shooting, to actually transferring ammunition from one depot to another. All of these things are vividly written in her memoir, which is over 800 pages, and it's one of the top-selling books of all time in Iran, named Da, or Mother, which is in Kurdish and Luri dialect means mother. And she has dedicated that to her mom and all the women in Iran, and she wants all the women to know that there are women like her that actually stood to kind of defend the country and defend their cities, and they did not expect anything from the state to kind of pay them back in some ways. The only thing that they want is recognition.
So I was going to ask you where it is you get your information about this, considering, you know, there might not have been as much data, at least official data on this. But so memoirs is a place where you're finding most of your information, which is also interesting because you've noted elsewhere that a lot of women who participated in the war were actually writing letters to men on the front lines or to the soldiers to encourage them and actually, you know, tell them to keep up the fight. So they were actually even, I don't know, cheerleaders from afar in some ways while they were writing to the people they didn't necessarily know. They were just writing to encourage, right?
Absolutely. One of the things that the soup kitchens did, they would actually get together once a week or twice a week. And this is not documented. It's only coming through the memoirs and kind of talking to people that were involved during the day when these things were happening. And they would actually get together, get some paper, get some pens, and have these women actually write to the fighters. And this is all put in a very patriotic slash religious sort of a context, that we are living the times of 680 when the Shiite Imam Hussein was basically murdered by a group of usurpers from Damascus. And they're saying, we didn't have a chance to defend the Imam then, but we are reliving basically the same catastrophe that was lived then. So we want you to continue. We are your sisters. We are your mothers, and we are your loved ones. And we are not begging you, but we're just here to tell you that we're here to support you in any way possible. So these letters were put inside the cheese sandwiches or the cheese vegetable sandwiches, which is very traditional in Iranian culture, and they were sent. And you hear from men, when you hear men's memoirs, when you read about them, they're like, these letters were just amazing because they were sitting in their bunkers, in their trenches, not knowing what would happen, and they would get these deliveries, and there would be not pictures, because they wouldn't send pictures, obviously, but they would get these letters letters that were signed, and they could imagine how these women had gotten together to make these things for them to eat. At the same time, they would care enough and take the time to actually address these things. So it was a very personal thing for them, which was very, very effective.
Did you find any commonalities among the women that were involved in the war in terms of from a certain social class, social economic class, or, educated, not educated? I mean, was it kind of a range? I mean, you mentioned the 17-year-old. Were they young? Were they older? I mean, or was it kind of a widespread thing that women were involved?
Yes. The women actually that were mostly involved and have taken the time to write these memoirs and publish them, the common denominator between all of them is that they come from a very lower social class. They're mostly rural or provincial. We do have women from Tehran, from the capital, that participated. And they're quite religious. So their argument is mostly offered in a religious context, in a Shiite ideological context. But also, they do not fail to tell us that they're patriots as well. So in the case of Zahra Hosseini, who was protecting her city, her Khorramshahr, in essence, she talks about how she's doing this for the love of God and for the love of her religion, but at the same time, she loves every inch of her streets, every inch of her land, she says, and that's very, very important to her. So you have a sort of a secular nationalist thing going on inside the minds of these people, such as Zahra Hosseini, and you also have the religious component that is very interesting. You do have women that I imagine we could call them seculars, people that were not so fond of the Islamic Republic or the system that had come to power by that time. But all the same, they did contribute in their own ways. These are the mostly very highly educated women that might have been educated in the United States or in the West somewhere else. And they were surgeons and they were nurses and anesthesiology technicians, so on and so forth. And we did have a Corps of Engineers of the Army that did have actually women working in them as well. So they might not have had the idea of religious sort of impetus that everybody else used, but they did it for the love of their country.
So now that you're bringing some of this to light about Iranian women during this particular war, what has the reaction been now that you're kind of talking about the role of women? Obviously, this memoir you mentioned is one of the bestsellers, so people understand that this has happened. And what are the implications for women today in Iran?
One thing that I like to kind of point out, and I do that in the book, hopefully more effectively, is that women in Iran, since the time of the Constitutional Revolution, which happened in 1906 to 1911, they've continuously tried to have their voices heard, and they tried to be involved in the civil process that was taking place. So that's very, very important. Although they hit up some walls along the way, but I see the whole thing as a historian. I see the whole thing as a continuity of something that has started over 100 years ago and is still continuing. So people that actually live in Iran and read these memoirs, they're quite taken by these because they're actually words of someone that has done something. And in Iranian culture, people, especially women, don't tend to talk about the most negative things that might have happened to them. Let me give you an example. There are many instances that we know of that we hear about women that were actually assaulted or raped and killed by the enemy, or women that actually have written about being taken captive as prisoners of war and serving time inside Iraq's intelligence jails, so on and so forth. However, they cannot talk about the taboo topics of rape and assault. And I think it's basically, people have to kind of understand the limitations of the culture, and they kind of have to read between the lines, because in many instances when you read the memoirs, you kind of know where this thing is going. But at the same time, women are being extremely brave and courageous to actually talk about it. For example, in one of the books, Amjadi talks about, the name of the book is I Am Alive. She talks about how this group of four women were held captive inside Saddam's jails in Comunicado for almost a year without any hygienic products being made available to them, and they had to use their socks to kind of take care of their feminine needs. And that's very, very heavy stuff. even in the United States, I imagine, let alone in an Islamic society, that these things are not talked about. And these women are extremely devout, extremely committed to their religion, but they are still courageous enough, and we have to give them credit for that. They are courageous enough to actually talk about it, to write about it, and to put it out there in the open. So their vulnerability is way, way open, but at the same time, there is a very brave and chivalrous thing that they're doing, that they're talking about it, which I think should be highlighted.
Well, as we finish today, Matteo, you've said before that in the past 10 years, women have really, in Iran, have really advanced considerably. Some of us may not think that, given the Islamic state that rules in Iran, but that women are going to school, they're becoming pilots, doctors, government officials, filmmakers. So at the end of the day, do you feel like women are doing well in Iran under this regime? Do you think that they'll continue to persist into the future in pushing for women's rights?
Let me answer this way. Women everywhere in the world are being prejudiced against, and that's nothing new. In the case of Iran, that's also the same thing. The Islamic Republic is not any different in many ways in treating of women. Some people might view what the Shah had done or what the monarchy had done was absolutely against women's rights in many ways. If you talk to Islamic feminists, they would argue probably for that. But at the same time, during the Islamic Republic, there were many instances where by default or by intention, women were allowed to do things that they could have never imagined could do. So their best was actually brought out by the system as well.
Very interesting. Thank you very much for being here with us.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to my conversation with Matteo Farzani. He's a history professor at Northeastern Illinois University in Chicago and the author of the forthcoming book, Iranian Women and Gender in the Iran-Iraq War. Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Jacob McClelland edited this interview, and Sam Dupre produced this show. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Gorlotte.